from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and by the Center for the Performing Arts, presenting the 2011-2012 season in three first-class venues.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Travis DiNicola. Today we're revisiting a few of our favorite interviews from this summer.
I'll find out about the Tiger Forest exhibit at the zoo.
I'll learn about the National Geographic exhibits at the Children's Museum.
And I'll get a preview of the new season at Clues Memorial Hall. And of course, we'll have our Arts Calendar Week Hall.
What do we do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Indianapolis Zoo is playing its part in conservation in a big way on several fronts, including creating a new habitat for its three Emir tigers. The habitat, called Tiger Forest, recently opened to great acclaim, and Sharon Gamble had the chance to talk with Nora Fletchell, VP of Conservation for the Zoo, about these tigers, why they're endangered, and what she learned about them on an extended research trip to Russia.
So before we talk about the cool research you got to do and your trip to Russia, can you describe the, and let me make sure I'm pronouncing it correctly, Emir tiger? To us?
Well, the Emir tiger is actually the largest species of tiger found on the planet. There used to be eight species of subspecies of tigers in the world, and now we're down to five, unfortunately. With Emir tigers being the largest, the males can get up to 600 pounds, and the females are about half that size. So they really are the what we call the apex predators of the Russian Far East. They're the largest cat on the face of the earth.
They're still pretty fast, though, even though they're...
I wouldn't call them speedy like a cheetah, but what I would call them is very lithe and agile and very deliberate in their movement. They are a stealth hunter. They're not a chaser. They'll sit and wait for their prey to come by and then stalk them that way versus chasing them down.
So they're strategizing. They're not just running after.
Yes. Strategizing is an excellent way to describe it. They are a very thoughtful, deliberate hunter.
I was surprised to learn that they can and do eat bears. I mean, that seems like a pretty big prey.
Yes, that was one of the things that I was surprised to learn when I did travel to Russia, was the fact that in this particular part of Russia where the Emir tiger lives, there are bear, and they do occasionally prey on bears.
What is their typical diet, though? What else will they eat?
Typically, they'll eat deer. There's a couple of different species of deer in that region, and wild boar is another big part of their diet.
Sounds kind of scary to chase down a wild boar.
Wild boar, actually, it's interesting. The researchers were telling me wild boar is actually probably even a little bit more dangerous for a tiger than, say, a bear. But tigers will eat anything from great big huge bears on down to mice, depending on what their needs are and what they can find.
They'll also eat domesticated animals. They'll eat pets if they're in the area, yeah?
Yeah, a dog to a tiger is another carnivore and
sure.
Therefore could be perceived as a threat. So the dogs that the people in Russia have as pets or as guard dogs are sometimes seen as a threat by tigers, and they will on occasion take dogs.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a significant issue, but it is something that they deal with, you know, on a fairly consistent basis.
So is that, let's talk about why tigers in general, but this breed in particular is endangered. People are hunting them for their beautiful pelts, yeah?
Well, there's basically two issues. One is the poaching or the illegal hunting, and the other one is just the thing that we face with all wildlife is the human-wildlife conflict. As the eastern part of Russia develops economically, what you're starting to see is more roads and more development taking place. And simply what that does is it just opens up the tiger's habitat to exposure to humans, thereby leading to, in some cases, conflict. Now, what happens when those roads are built, that facilitates humans coming in and doing things like establishing logging camps, which actually sometimes, if done right and legally in concert with the government, works quite effectively. But when it doesn't, or when it just exposes these tigers to humans, it opens up tigers to poaching, and a pelt of a tiger and tiger parts are still a large part of the black market for tigers. And so one poacher could make as much as $80,000 US, which is a huge amount of money in Russia or in China or, you know, other parts of Asia. And so that potential to gain that income is a huge incentive, unfortunately, for poaching.
And it's hard to just, it's not like you can communicate with the tigers and say, just move away from the region that the roads have just opened up in there. That can't be done.
Exactly, because these roads provide places for tigers to sit. Tigers like to watch and find prey, so roads are open spaces where prey will move through deer and other types of things. So the tigers tend to go to the roads because then it's easier for them to find prey. Then they're exposed, unfortunately, to humans. They're exposed occasionally to being hit by cars or trucks or those types of things as well. So it's one of those things where there's a very delicate balance there. And the researchers in Russia and the conservation biologists are working hard towards trying to maintain that balance.
Now, am I correct in assuming that it's not just the beautiful fur, but that there's some medicinal qualities perceived to be, the organs or what is used for medicine?
Virtually all parts of a tiger do have some significance in traditional Oriental medicine. And so, and it could be organs, it could be particular bones or those types of things that are seen particularly in China as having medicinal value. So that drives up the demand for those parts, those black market acquired parts. So unfortunately, it's something where you have to look at the culture that those people have been living in for thousands and thousands of years. That's a very valuable part of their culture. And so how do we work together to get them to understand that the negative impact that has on tigers in the wild, not just in eastern Russia, but throughout a tiger's range, which is pretty much everywhere from India on east through parts of Russia, through China, and Southeast Asia as well.
So in the process, we should say that the zoo is home to three tigers right now, and tell us where they came from and kind of how they interact with one another.
Well, right now we have three. We have one male and two females. Now, in the wild, tigers live completely solitary lives for the most part.
Really?
Except for mothers and their cubs. And then they'll come together, obviously, for breeding, one male and one female. So our male, Pecha, has been with us for a little while. He came to us from another zoo. And Andrea, our newest female, actually came to us just late last year from the St. Louis Zoo. And Sila, who is actually born here at the zoo, her linkage is very closely tied to a female who was imported into this country as an orphan back in the mid-1990s. So she's kind of the link to the past with our tigers at the Indianapolis Zoo. We have a very great staff, and we have a very, very capable staff, and we've been able to actually breed and produce cubs for several years here. And so those three tigers, what you'll typically see is the exhibit area is actually two exhibits. And so when you come, you may see one of the females in one of the exhibits and the other female and a male in the other exhibit. Adult female tigers don't get along so well. so you probably won't ever see the two females together, but we are hoping to be able to breed a couple of those animals. And so we hope in the future to be able to produce cubs to continue to have that very important tiger population in zoos, so we can really show people what they are like and help them to learn what the issues are and the challenges are with tiger conservation.
In the wild, does the father stay around after the cubs are born?
No, he'll move away. Their home range in the wild is huge. A typical tiger's home range, if you look at the 465 circle around Indianapolis, mm-hmm. a tiger's home range is about half of that.
Wow.
So one individual tiger would have about half of that circle.
It's a big hunting
territory. That's a huge hunting territory, and they need that because that's their prey base. Deer and boar have very large home ranges as well. So in order to support one tiger, you need that much land.
Sure. So how long does it take for the cub to reach maturity, and how does the mother, I know this is a kind of a naive question, but I don't live in the wild, so I have to ask it. How does the mother get food while she's nursing the cub? And, you know, obviously she's got to recover a little bit from giving birth.
Usually for the first few days, she'll stick pretty close by with the cubs. Tiger cubs, just like domestic cats, are born blind, and their ears, they can't hear anything for the first few weeks. And so they'll stay very close. They'll stay in the den. The dens that these tigers build are very secluded and very secretive. So she'll leave the cubs, and she'll go off and she'll hunt. And she'll gradually, as the cubs' eyes open and their ears open up, she'll gradually start to introduce meat into their diet while she's nursing. But she'll leave those cubs for brief periods of time to go off and hunt, and then she'll come back to them, not in any more than a few hours or something along those lines. But then as the cubs grow, she'll teach them to hunt. Very similar to what you might see if you have a cat or a kitten, and, you know, they're tearing up toys and, you know, stalking and that. Tigers learn from their mothers. They are taught how to hunt by their mothers. And so that's how they learn as well, through experiment and trial and error, just like your kitten learns how to catch mice at home.
Yeah. How long does it take before the cub is old enough to, is mature, basically?
Usually it's 18 months to 2 years.
Okay.
They'll move away, move off from their mother. Usually at around a year to 14 months, you'll start to see that separation.
And what's a typical litter? Is it just one or two cubs?
It's typically anywhere from one. Four is very unusual. So you're talking about usually two to three is the average size, but one individual cub in the wild is not unusual.
Wow. Yeah. When you obviously you had tigers at the zoo before you went to Russia to try to get a little bit more information before the newly designed habitat. What were you expecting when you went to Russia, and what did you learn that might have challenged your expectations?
Well, I think before I went, I had some very naive assumptions about how the people that live in that part of Russia would react to tigers. I just assumed that perhaps they didn't care about tigers, that they were kind of ambivalent about having tigers. But when I got over there, what I found was the people that live in these regions where these tigers are found are very respectful of the tigers. They like having tigers in their area.
Hmm.
It's a symbol of their heritage. It's a symbol of the wild, which they are very, very integrated. Their lifestyle is very, very integrated with the wild in terms of it's not very developed in that area where you'll see tigers. So they're much more dependent on the land.
Mm-hmm.
And they have this tremendous respect and almost reverence for tigers. When you talk to the people that live in the villages, they want to have tigers. They don't necessarily want to see them, but they don't mind that they're there.
Hmm. And there was a particular couple you worked with who've done a lot for conservation. How did you find them, and what did they tell you that's useful for you back here?
Sure. Dr. Linda Curley is an American-born conservation biologist who has dedicated her life to the conservation and recovery of Amur tigers. And she works along with her husband, Misha Boroshenko, who is a native Russian. They live in the Russian Far East, and they actually are sponsored by the Zoo Society of London. And so I've got in contact with them through some of my colleagues. And Dr. Curley and Misha have been studying tigers for nearly 20 years in Russia. And they've been looking at this one particular state reserve and monitoring the tiger population there, working with the local officials very effectively at education programs about tigers, learning as much as they can about the habitat and the needs of those animals, with a long-term goal of obviously maintaining and growing a very viable population of tigers. Fantastic people. Made a lot of sacrifices in their lives in order to be able to do this fantastic work.
In interacting with the tigers here at the Indianapolis Zoo, what are some of your favorite moments? What do you like to watch them do?
Well, what's really neat about our new exhibit, the Tiger Forest, presented by Citizens Energy Group, is the fact that you will be able to get within inches of a tiger. Now, if you contrast that to Dr. Curley's work in Russia, she's been there almost 20 years. She's actually only seen a live tiger about a dozen times.
Wow.
So she has not had nearly as a robust of an experience and getting up close and personal with those tigers, as you will be able to have at our new exhibit, separated by just an inch and a half of glass from a tiger. You'll be able to see their whiskers. You'll be able to look right into those animals' eyes. And when I was out at the exhibit yesterday, our cats are wonderful. They're coming right up to that glass where they can, so you'll be able to see them. You'll be able to get an idea of how big they are and how magnificent they really look.
Sharon Gamble with Nora Fletchell, VP of Conservation for the Indianapolis Zoo. See the Emir Tigers in the Tiger Forest habitat. For more information, visit IndianapolisZoo.com.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. The Children's Museum of Indianapolis opened a new exhibit in June called National Geographic Treasures of the Earth. Well, actually, it's three new exhibits, including an Egyptian tomb, a pirate shipwreck, and some ancient Chinese warriors. Travis DiNicola spoke with the museum's president and CEO, Jeffrey Patchen, about this new permanent exhibit and partnership.
Jeff, welcome to our studio. It's great to see you here in person today. I think the last time we talked was by phone, and you were on a boat on the Nile.
2 years ago.
Two years ago.
We were scheduled to go to take a group, our second group of family, family travelers over to Egypt on March 27th, but obviously of this year. But obviously that was canceled due to all the unrest there.
Things have changed a bit.
Yeah, they certainly have.
Well, you have, so 2 years ago, you were on the Nile, and we were chatting about this very exhibit that's going to be opening in June. This has got to be so exciting. I know you've been working on the National Geographic exhibit in partnership for quite a while. Where would you like to start in talking
about it?
Well,
you know, the partnership with National Geographic has just been just the best to partner with. The relationship goes back almost 7 years when we conceived of an exhibit about maps, because kids and families need to know where they are and where we've come from and all of that. So we developed this traveling exhibit called National Geographic Maps, Tools for Adventure. And part of what National Geographic contributed was a focus on six National Geographic explorers, of which Dr. Zahi Hawass, who's chair of the Supreme Council of Antiquities in Egypt, was one, and led us to a whole series of relationships related to everything from helping to design a new children's museum in Cairo to the content for this exhibit, which focuses on this incredible tomb of the Pharaoh Seti I, one of the most beautiful and glorious tombs in the Valley of the Kings. And it's just, of course, National Geographic is that incredible treasure trove of photography and images of the world.
Now, you know, of course, this is incredibly educational and kids are going to love it. But I must say, I mean, it seems like more of the type of an exhibit that, you know, a history museum or a science museum or, you know, or even the Metropolitan Museum of Art would have as opposed to a children's museum.
Well, thank you for recognizing that. We work very hard at an approach that we call family learning. Even though our name is the Children's Museum of Indianapolis, there is just as much for adults as there is for children. And necessarily when we create these large permanent spaces, like we are with National Geographic, we want to engage the entire family. And so there'll be lots of information and activities for adults as well as, of course, for children and youth.
Very good. Now, and this is a permanent exhibit,
not
just a traveling or touring or temporary piece. Where in the Children's Museum is it going to be physically located?
This will be actually in two levels. The lower level, and our visitors may and friends may remember a gallery called What If that actually had a mummy in it for a period long period of time and some dinosaurs and underwater kind of thing. And the level just above that, in level one, which we've created kind of an overlook into the gallery space, and a special new elevator, new lift, that will actually take visitors from the second floor down to the lower level in a kind of a themed descent experience.
Okay, and this is on the right. Is that correct? When you walk into the
lobby,
yes,
it is.
Okay, I'm just trying to sort of picture where it all is. Now there's three major exhibits that are part of the National Geographic Treasures of the Earth. Tell me a little bit about each one, if you would.
Well, we wanted to cover the idea was archaeology, and we know from Dinosphere that kids just love paleontology and they love digging and all of that kind of thing. And everybody kind of has these mysteries around legendary fiction and sometimes nonfiction characters like Indiana Jones.
Right. Of course, right.
So, and quest for things unfound and the mysteries of the past. And so we really wanted to spend some time delving into archaeology. And so we selected three three incredible excavations, even though they were discovered in the two of them discovered quite a while ago in the past, are revealing new science. In the case of the tomb of Seti I, there's new information about a shaft leading into this tomb. And so visitors will have an opportunity to figure out where does that shaft lead and what are the clues along the way that might tell us about whose tomb is at the end. The second is the Terracotta Warriors of Xi'an, which were discovered in the mid-70s by a farmer digging for water for a well, and discovered these thousands of terracotta soldiers from the Emperor Qin dynasty. And, of course, the new science there is that they've discovered that these were not plain gray-brown figures as we've come to see them in all the pictures, but they were very brightly painted from some new research about the chemicals that have been discovered.
And each one's completely different.
Each one has some features that are unique and different, mostly the facial features. And there are even some variations in the paint, which are very interesting. And then the third is a more recent find by underwater archaeologist right here in our own state, Professor Charlie Beaker from Indiana University, who found the shipwreck of Captain Kidd the pirate in 10 feet of water in the Dominican Republic. And it's turning that dive site into that excavation site into an underwater park, which we are dedicating next week with Charlie in the Dominican Republic. It's very exciting.
Now on that one, how does something in 10 feet of water go undiscovered for so long?
Well, it's an interesting story. It is actually 20 minutes away from the coast of the Dominican Republic and just literally 10 or 15 feet off a coral shelf, which is on a little tiny island called Catalina. It's not the Catalina in California. Mm-hmm. It's the Catalina off the coast of the Dominican Republic. And what happened was that Kidd's ship was offloaded on the mainland, set ablaze, left the cannon in it, and it sailed across on its own until it bumped into this island of Catalina and sank ablaze. Mm-hmm. And the cannon just remained in this pile. And, of course, over the years, it was 1699, I think, when it sank. Over the years, became encrusted with coral and the like. And then a local diver found it and reported it. And the government, along with Charlie, kind of...
Eventually, they sort of realized what it was.
And Charlie's been able to confirm the kid that was Kid's ship because he found some teak wood at the site, and the teak wood was joined in a way called a rabbit joint that he had never seen before, and there was only one shipbuilder in that time period in India, and he traced this back to. Various historical journals, et cetera, to a family that was building teak ships in that particular time period in India. He traveled over to India.
Wow.
The same family is in the business.
Still.
It has the records of that family business today.
Huh.
It's the magic of the past that, you know, you never know where the mysteries are and how close to human history today the past is.
Yeah, wow, that's just fascinating. Now, with the kid's ship, you'll have on display the cannon, is that
correct? We have it on display. Okay. We will have it on display. It's in the museum now in a very special large tank, and we'll now be one of the three sites for conservation of artifacts from the Dominican Republic. There's a wet lab that the Dominican Republic government has. There's one that Charlie has at IU. And now we'll be the third to have a functioning wet lab, which will begin to expose these pieces by removing all of the incrustation and barnacles and corals and all of that. Right.
So it's in water. I mean,
it's in fresh water with a chemical process and electricity called electrolytic reduction.
Wow.
And over that time, over a time period of about 2 years, our visitors will be able to see this cannon shape becoming clearer and clearer and clearer.
Oh, how neat.
Matter of fact, Charlie's had it, I think, for almost 8 months or a year now, and there is an insignia that has revealed itself on the side of the cannon, which, again, further confirms where it was made, et cetera, et cetera. So
excellent.
It's very exciting.
That's very cool. I mean, reasons certainly to keep going back and seeing how that
absolutely
evolves.
And we just received this incredible grant from the Lilly Company Foundation for a series of additional expeditions for the Kara Merchant for kids' ship, one for a 1725 Spanish galleon that Charlie has found called the Begonia, which was found in 3 feet of sand and water, not far from the runway at the Santo Domingo Airport. And the third ship he's looking for, and he believes he has some strong indication of maybe present, is one of the Lost Fleet of Columbus.
Wow.
Which is just so exciting to have
a children's museum
engaged in this with National Geographic and Charlie. Just makes this all come alive for children and families.
I mean, did you ever imagine when you got into the business of children's museums that you'd be doing this type of work? I mean, this is
This is what and I think most of the staff in the museum and the board and volunteers as well. We think the best stories are the true ones, and so that's why we promote real humanities, real arts, real sciences, and trying to bring the real stories of the past to life for children and families versus fictional kinds of things.
So. Now I did mention, of course, that the cannon is a real artifact.
I
do want to be clear that with the Terracotta Warriors, these are recreations.
These are replicas, right?
Replicas, okay. And then there's sort of a combination of both with the Tomb of Seti?
Absolutely. We have some objects from Seti's tomb. We have some Schwabtis and some other small pieces on loan from the British Museum and a number of other locations that will be on display and then rotated out and other objects brought in of that particular time period. We're working hard with the Shaanxi Regional Provincial Government in Xi'an to bring some real terracotta warriors here in the future, which we think will be very exciting as well.
Wow, that'd be fantastic.
Yeah.
How very neat. Congratulations on
Thank
all
you.
This. Yeah, it's just great stuff, which leads me to a question that a friend of mine asked me the other day. And he said, I love the Children's Museum, but do you think they would ever consider having an adults-only night just to for all the adults who want to see this stuff, who maybe don't have kids, who don't want to?
Well, it's funny when we do tours for adults and they say, this place would be a lot of fun if there just weren't so many kids around. And we kind of laugh, but
of course
we do have, of course, behind the scenes and some tours and things like that for adults. But that's a good idea, Travis. We need to take back and see if once in a while we could do an adults only evening or something like that.
Or maybe a rent-a-kid thing for those of us who don't have kids.
There you go.
Takes some there. Now, of course, Jeff, while I got you here, just briefly, you've got a lot of other great exhibits there, fun things going on this summer. Anything else you'd like to share with us?
It'll be an exciting summer with National Geographic. It opens June 11th. Mm-hmm. There's a gala on June 4th for anyone that would like to attend. Just let the museum know. And in the fall, we're bringing in a very exciting exhibit called Frogs.
Okay.
Which is hundreds of live frogs
and
a frog handler with them. And from the smallest little tiny tree frog to the big cane toads. And it's very, very exciting. And then, of course, the haunted house.
Of course.
Which is always, always fun. Mm-hmm. And then Jolly Days, which follows that as well.
Sure, of course. And all the other great things, the Big Chihuly piece.
And we still have Dora and Diego. Mm-hmm. That's a traveling exhibit that we put together with Nickelodeon that will be here for a bit longer, and then we'll go on tour.
Very good, very good. Jeff, a pleasure to chat with you.
Thank you, Travis.
Again, congratulations on these great exhibits. I can't wait to see them.
Travis DiNicola with Jeffrey Patchen, President and CEO of the Children's Museum of Indianapolis. The exhibit National Geographic Treasures of the Earth is open now. More information is at childrensmuseum.org.
Well, Sharon?
Yes, Travis.
It is, not technically, but it kind of, at least seasonally, is autumn.
Oh!
But... The fun does not fall in autumn. It just keeps on going.
Oh, you did not say that.
I did.
If I leave you alone, you make terrible puns.
That's awful. So, but there are lots of great things. In fact, lots of organizations kicking off their seasons. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we've got Penrod and all sort of other great things going on this weekend on that calendar we call
What'll We Do? If you're listening on Friday night, make plans to come out to Penrod. Come early. Come at 9 and shop and buy great visual artworks from local and national artists. It's one of the loveliest adjudicated art shows, and virtually every cultural and performing arts booth organization has a booth at Penrod.
That's
so
right.
You can go around and collect everybody's season brochures, and especially we invite you to come visit with us
The
WFYI Blues stage.
Again, that is going on Saturday, and so if you're listening Friday night, that's great. If you're listening Saturday afternoon, well, we hope you saw you.
We
saw you, but if we didn't, then you missed us.
Too
bad. But there's other great things to do, as... What do you got? Oh, you know, well, tonight, of course, is Evening with the Stars at Old National Center. It's the Indianapolis City Ballet. It's the big performance, and I cannot wait. Saturday night is the night for it, and it is just going to be a ton of fun and definitely worth checking out.
Mm-hmm. Either night, whether you're listening on Friday night or Saturday afternoon, you can still make it to Greek Fest, which you... have just heard about. And
last weekend,
and amazing food, very family friendly atmosphere. Kids can learn traditional Greek dancing. Make sure you take advantage of the opportunity to go inside the church, especially if you're not too familiar with Greek Orthodox architecture and church architecture in particular. There, it's a lovely opportunity to find out about that church, which is fairly new.
Cool.
Yeah.
Hey, a lot of organizations are opening their weekends, their seasons this weekend, IRT has Dracula, If You Dare, that is running now through October 11th. Can sink your teeth into that
one. That's right.
Mm-hmm. Should be a lot of fun.
I never drink wine.
And then Phoenix Theater is opening Spring Awakening on September 22nd, and that runs through the 23rd, a musical at the Phoenix.
Mm-hmm. If you are kind of inclined to be artistic, but maybe you're a little out of practice, or you think, oh, I'm sort of artistic, but I need to work with a team of people, I have the exact opportunity for you. The Arts Council of Indianapolis is still looking for volunteers to assist both local and national artists with the creation of murals for the 46 for 46 mural program. You heard about it recently on the Art of the Matter. Volunteers are needed through Halloween, and artists will need help with some or all of the following: cleaning, wall preparation, priming, application of the design, and painting. If you have some experience with painting, that's sort of the ideal situation. If this intrigues you, send an email with your availability to Lindsay Lord at llord@indiearts.org. llord@indiearts.org, and tell her your level of experience, and she'll match you with the right person.
There you go. Hey, Irish Fest is coming up next weekend, the 16th annual Indies Irish Fest, September 16th, 17th, 18th, down at Military Park. It's a celebration of Celtic heritage with four stages of live Irish music and step dancing, shopping, food, children's activities, sporting events. That's right. There's like
Does this involve the sheep?
And there's sheep herding, too. So it is an awesome weekend, always a great time, lots of great food and drink and fun for literally the whole family, and it doesn't matter if your last name starts with an O or not, everyone's Irish at Irish Fest.
I love that. And now for another nationality, the 21st annual French Market is this Saturday, starting at noon. If you're hearing us Saturday afternoon, don't despair, because it goes till 10 on Saturday night. It's on the grounds of St. Joan of Arc Church, which is at 42nd and Central, and it is a there's kind of a food theme. We often talk about food on our calendar.
It is
a great opportunity to sample some amazing food. There's American cuisine, but of course, lots and lots of French cuisine, because it is French Market. Admission is free, but take some money with you. There are bands, including the Stardusters, Second Wind, Mojo Gumbo, and Living Proof. And on the menu, things such as French onion soup, escargot, oysters, French bread and herb butter, rotisserie chicken, and as they say, much, much more.
Oh.
That's this Saturday.
Oh.
French Market.
Trivian. That sounds awesome.
Allons-y.
Rocky Ripple has their own festival coming up on Saturday, September 24th. If you can find the Rocky Ripple neighborhood, then the festival is free from 11 to 6 on Saturday the 24th. Includes 6 local bands, over 60 artists, as well as community-constructed bat houses. How fun is that? So that's at Rocky Ripple, and if you don't know how to get there, then you better ask somebody.
And our joke, in case you think we're just randomly making fun of a neighborhood, is lots of people who live in Rocky Ripple sport bumper stickers that say, "I'm not lost, I live here." Rocky Ripple, I think it moves.
Hard to get into, hard to get out of, but
I think
it's
like Brigadoon, I think, or Camelot, it just appears magically. Hey, Butler University, speaking of things in that kind of part of the north side, Butler is accepting applications for its community fiction workshop, which begins September 21st. The course meets on Wednesday nights from 7:15 to 9:45 at Butler's new Ephraimson Creative Writing Center. The cost is $200. Send an application letter and writing sample to Dan Barden at dbarden@butler.edu. By September 15th. You don't need to be working on a degree. A lot of people have used it as a stepping stone to get a project like a novel or a chapbook started. More information, email Dan, dbarden@butler.edu.
And last thing I've got this week, Steel Magnolias is being produced by Zionsville's Community Theater, the Off Main Street Players. It opens next weekend, the 16th and 17th, and runs through the 24th.
Very good.
Check out offmainstreetplayers.org for more information.
And my last item is, don't forget that All My Sons, the great Arthur Miller classic, it's the one that that isn't The Crucible or Death of a Salesman, but just as fine a work. It is up on stage right now at Cardinal Stage Company in Bloomington, and it runs through September 18th. All My Sons by Arthur Miller. If you've never seen it on stage, do yourself a favor and go.
Great. And we will be back next week with more things to do on that calendar we call
What Will We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
Clues Memorial Hall of Butler University recently announced its 2011-2012 season, and Sharon Gamble wanted to learn more about it and about some new programming twists, so she invited Clues Community Relations Manager James Kramer in to tell us more.
The traditional season is Clues Presents.
Clues Presents.
Yes. And interesting because we don't think of it as traditional. Certainly the series is now, but the offerings are very eclectic, very, I think that's what is traditional. We can count on it being a varied season. A little dance, a little music, a little spoken word, and we've got all of that this year. We've got 6 shows.
I thought of the old, the vaudeville classic, A Little Song, A Little Dance, A Little Seltzer Down the Pants. Sorry.
I think I had
Groucho Marx in my ear or something like that. Well, really, the variety that you have does speak to that, all the way from Huey Lewis to Mike Birbiglia. But let's go in order.
Well, we launched the season in October, Saturday night. All of our shows this year are 8 o'clock. But they alternate between Friday and Saturday nights. Mm-hmm. So Saturday night, October 8th, will be Esperanza Spalding, who was this year named as Grammy Award winner for Best New Artist. And she beat out the likes of Justin Bieber and Mumford and Son. So, but just for people to have a point of reference that says, okay, this is the you know, meaning of those kind of awards. Very often they all just sort of blend together. But in this case, it's quite an honor. And we were very pleased that we had already been speaking with the agent about her coming before we got the announcement she was even up for the award. So then this just kind of adds that little bit of credential to it for those.
And for people who aren't familiar with her. Mm-hmm.
Esperanza Spalding is, new artist, but she's a jazz bassist as well as singer. And she does some other standards, too, as well as then a little bit of funk. And she's coming with a chamber music society, so it will not be just her on stage, which is very often our shows are a small ensemble thing, if it's not a solo performer. So I think a nice blend between that and a full orchestra, having the chamber music there is going to be just a really nice blend. And what I've heard, it's just amazing. I just didn't really know what to expect, but she is just a lovely, lovely voice, and just amazing what she does with the instruments. So that's going to be great to have her in, kicking off the season. And then we follow that with Huey Lewis and the News. As you mentioned, that's going to be Saturday night, October 22nd, which happens to be homecoming weekend at Butler as well. So we're hoping that, that aligned with the 25th anniversary class, those kinds of things will be really great and exciting. And
yeah, a special shout out to people who graduated in the 80s, because that was like the apogee of Huey Lewis and the News. I mean, he still rocks, though.
That's going to be the heart of rock and roll all in one evening.
All right, we'll stop before we start quoting too many lyrics here.
Okay.
You always have, and I know you have a special fondness for dance as a dancer. Tell us about the Luna Negra Dance Theater and Turtle Island Quartet.
Well, they're coming down from Chicago. They're primarily a Latin dance form-based company, a modern company. And the fact that we're going to be having that with Turtle Island Quartet and live music, dance, live music, sort of a rarity.
Yeah.
Expense, time, rehearsal periods, just a variety of things.
And consistency of rhythm.
Oh,
it's so much easier to do it with a recording.
Oh, yes. And so many things, especially with contemporary work, is not your traditional music. It's oftentimes, in some way been mixed in the studio,
right,
or it's electronic, or it's in some other way than what really is conducive to having a live accompaniment there.
Will the quartet be on stage with the dancers?
That's a good question. I'm not sure.
Do we know yet?
I'm not sure. What I understand of reading is there is a piece that that is specifically been choreographed with this in mind, so that it is more of like a club in Cuba. So that has that feeling. So I'm thinking it could be that it will be on stage in that. But I haven't seen any tech specs of where they are, to be during performance and all. But definitely having that is going to be just, I think, just wonderful. I mean, just, to have dance, but then to have live music just as a foundation for that is just an amazing experience for patrons to come. And speaking personally, I think it's just a wonderful, wonderful opportunity to have that. And we're really featuring that in our outreach activities and all things we're doing. We're featuring dance music components to the speakers, to the activities we do, and things like that. And I'll tell you a little bit more about some of those activities.
Yeah, we're going to talk about some of those outreach activities in a moment.
But I'll move on to the next thing on the series is Naturally 7, and that's on Friday, November 11th. So we have Naturally 7 on 11/11. So that's the way I'm remembering that, because all these dates rolling around
right,
your
right.
head. But it is a male a cappella group have been opening for Michael Bublé. So there's a little point of reference if people are looking at. And again, another as was Esperanza and Huey. Actually, the Naturally 7 is a Grammy Award winners as well. So it's a award-winning season from that standpoint. They'll be in doing their vocal wonders, and it's just...
And what kinds of music do they normally tackle?
I think that kind of eclectic, but it's... jazzy, pop.
So kind of the King Singers territory, maybe a little more pop than King Singers, maybe more like... what's the really hot ensemble out of Bloomington?
Straight No Chaser.
Straight No Chaser.
Yes.
Yeah.
Along that line, where there's the whole beatbox feel going in, and just being the a cappella format of being it all.
Yeah.
So it's sort of in contrast to Luna, where it's dance with music. This is music without the instruments. So there you go. It's really, I think, going to be an amazing, and again, and listening to recordings of them, and all of this, of course, is available online in different places. But it's just some amazing things that people can do with the human voice.
Yeah.
It is just always blows me away that, you know, you keep thinking, oh, I've seen it, I've heard it all, and then you get one more and you're like, well, no, I haven't.
This is,
yes.
Who knew?
Yes. We have what seems like a big gap, but we'll talk about that in a minute of why that is, but Bela Fleck and the Flecktones will be joining us. It's the original lineup, and that's going to be Friday, March 30th. And it's just going to be such a joy to have Bela back, because he's such a giving performer, artist, human being. He's was here a few years ago. We had him in the spring, in February, with the Africa Project. And it seemed like it was a little quick to have an artist back in that soon, because we do like to, when we, you know, have artists in that are popular, successful, and they're great to work with, we like to have them back.
Sure.
But we like to have enough time to put in other things,
right,
so it's not
right.
just an annual thing. Well, because this is the Flecktones and the original lineup, and the fact that there is enough of a gap in that from season to season, that we feel that it was time to have him back in. And so we're able to capitalize on the previous experience in some of these outreach activities that we're going to be doing.
And he does something, in my experience at Clues, that is not all that easy to do. You know, you have a big hall, but he seems very conversational with the audience. He seems like he's really taking energy from the audience, as all performers do, but it seems like you're seeing him in a club where there's 50 people instead of 2,000 people.
And that is a really good point, Sharon. It is just an amazing venue that, even though it's large and you have this sea, this vast sea, uninterrupted, you know, with continental-style seating of humanity out there, you know, hopefully sell-out crowd, that you can feel this very personal, intimate experience. I think the acoustics, certainly, the sight lines, you know, but the fact that a performer can sense the audience so well as to be conversational with them, whether it's in the, you know, planned performance or something improvised that, you know, just in conversation with. It really creates an environment that is so intimate and so personal. And you can say that, oh, you're experiencing it with 2,000 of your closest friends. But it really is that feeling. And I think that's an amazing, amazing feature that the hall, just the structure, the just the environment is created there to have that kind of experience.
And so, considering that it's 40, how many years old?
Yeah, approaching almost, 48,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, getting
year,
close so getting, to 50.
Yes, we are.
Yeah.
And so that, I think, is a real plus for people who want to have that kind of feel, like you say,
yeah.
You know, it's a club feel in the auditorium setting.
Yeah.
So we finish up with a comedian, Mike Birbiglia. Some folks on the dial here know that. There are a couple of places on the dial that he appears as well, which I find very interesting. So there's a great crossover between,
right.
you know, from Bob and Tom to FYI. I mean, we've got a wide range of listeners to this stand-up comic. He's going to be doing his show, My Girlfriend's Boyfriend. And so it's just going to be, it's, you know, so often you think, okay, what's in a title? Well, it kind of sums it up.
Yeah.
There you go. So this is
their
show.
It's a twisty road, what can I say?
So I think that's going to be a real fun way to finish out. That's on Saturday, April 28th. And again, those are just available in the season package right now, which some great benefits to being, you know, to savings, of course, a huge savings when you do subscriptions. But priority seating, ticket exchanges, VIP reception. So there are a variety of things that really make that more than just the ticket price. Certainly, you know, they're very affordable anyway. I think you can get, you know, probably average $21. Per show, if you get the whole series,
yeah,
you know,
that's,
so
that's
and then
quite a
and then
steal.
Up depending on where you are. So
yeah.
You know, you can do a variety of things like that, and then of course you can always do the single tickets after we let the subscribers have their first picks in the fall. We'll open it up so that all the shows you can get your single tickets for those as well.
So
and,
what's going on in the hall between November and March?
Well, a little thing called Super Bowl, we hope. That's kept out a couple weekends for us. You know, we're not going to be hosting necessarily the Super Bowl there, but we,
sure.
you know, if something needs to be downtown and a downtown venue needs to come and have a performing space, we've, you know, years ago when we were talking about hosting, we all were asked to save dates.
Right.
So, and very well may, for instance, the symphony may come up and do a concert
sure.
there so that the circle could be available for other, you know, activities closer to the stadium.
Right.
So those kinds of things make it sort of shift around. So we've left a big chunk there, but we also have an alternative lineup that I want to tell you about. And this is not a series. It is a new model for us. We're trying a new just a new lineup. Trying to think what, because it's not a series, so that people can get these shows and we can continue adding to them. We find that a lot of things, the old model of here's your series, here's your season, that's it, we don't ever add to it, is just that. It's an old model.
Right
now we have an opportunity mid-year. We've got time available in the calendar. Perfect fit. Well, formerly we'd say, well, let's put it into next season.
Mm-hmm.
It's available now.
Right.
Let's get this act
Let's
in here.
It.
This is timely. It's important. We have an opportunity. There it is. So it's an ongoing year-round type of model. So this alternative lineup called Clues Off Center, which is starts off with Henson Alternative. Puppeteers.
I love the description of this.
It's Stuffed and Unstrung is their title, and it really is adult puppet theater, if you will. I mean,
so it's like, what if you just let them go and said you don't have to be child friendly.
Right, and it is actually very definitely. It is an adult only show because we're gonna they will accept ideas from the audience. Called out. What do you want to see the puppets do?
Mm-hmm.
And as we know, that can go all over the map.
That can get naughty really fast.
It could be a lot of fun. But people know what they're coming in for. It is not
right.
is not a child's puppet show, even though it is Henson Muppets.
Right.
You know, very well known, well respected, high quality of puppeteering. But to be able to do it as a stand up improv with the puppets. I mean, just how many more components could we add to that? I think it's just an amazingly fun evening in store there. And that's Friday, September 30th. And then we go to the spring. This is sort of that fills in that gap a bit.
Mm-hmm.
With January, this is a Friday night, January 20th, and it's Street Drum Corps. It's three guys that do, a combination of different genres of music from sort of a grunge band, rock, punk, dance, techno, and it's just a raucous concert. So it's just going to be a lot of fun.
Sharon Gamble with Clues Memorial Hall Community Relations Manager James Kramer. Learn more about their season at clueshall.org. That's CLOWES hall.org.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And if you're listening to this broadcast on Friday night, please remember to visit us tomorrow afternoon at Penrod, where we will be broadcasting live at the WFYI booth from noon until 4 p.m.
And if you're listening to us on Saturday, then we hope you had a delightful day at Penrod.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next weekend when I chat with Western writer Larry Sweezy.
I'll find out about a young poet's work.
And I'll talk with international musician Yuval Ron. Plus, we'll also have our arts calendar we call What'll We Do?
So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you. And by the Center for the Performing Arts, presenting the 2011-2012 season in three first-class venues. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.